Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today's episode is incredibly straightforward. I'm speaking with John Wolfstahl about nuclear weapons and nuclear policy as we move deeper and deeper into the Ukraine-Russia crisis following Russia's invasion of the country. So many big things to hit here. We engage on everything from the history of the U.S. nuclear weapons policies, whether or not the invasions of Iraq and the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya have made it more, not less likely for regimes to refuse to give up the nuclear weapons, and what this all means going forward for how we should consider and even think about nuclear disarmament. That's something we can even achieve. Lots of great stuff here. Hope you enjoy the episode. Quick note, as I said before, Sagar's making his triumphant return later today. So if you have any questions, topics, comments, etc. for us to go over, be sure to write in to realignmentpod@gmail.com. Leave a comment on YouTube, reply to the Substack, leave us a 5-star review, whatever fits your preferences. Lots of great stuff, as I said. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Let's get into the episode. John Wolfstahl, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to start with a very basic question you've been asked a million times, but it's the number one question people are thinking, considering the episode. Given this stage of the conflict in Ukraine, how concerned are you about nuclear escalation?
So I worry about nuclear weapons all the time. I have my entire adult life. And so I think before I give you my answer, a recognition that it's not as if nuclear danger sort of reemerged a month and a half ago. The United States has lived with the threat of nuclear weapons since we no longer had a monopoly on those weapons back in 1949. That changed a lot after the end of the Cold War and in the early 1990s and most of the 2000s. I think the threat was relatively low. We worried a little bit about escalation or mistakes, theft. We had a major period where we worried about nuclear terrorism. But for the most part, you know, we didn't wake up every morning worried about whether we'd be able to go to sleep that night. I think as President Putin has become more aggressive, as China has expanded their nuclear ambitions, and as the reliance on our military to interact with other countries has grown, the risk of escalation has become more dominant. And in fact, over the last several years, experts have talked about the greatest risk of nuclear use is not through a deliberate decision to strike, but through escalation dynamics, where Russia thinks we're going to go first, and so they preempt or vice versa. Now that we're in an actual shooting war, where Russia is engaged in major military activities in Europe, and where NATO forces are just across the border from some of those missile strikes, the threat has greatly increased. And I don't think anybody can give you an accurate number or give you a percentage probability. But the way I look at it is, generally, the default is that we won't have a nuclear escalation. There's enough time, there's enough security in place that a year ago, 2 years ago, if something went wrong, you could pick up the phone, you could call the Russians or the Chinese or vice versa, and you could work it out. I think now we're basically on the knife's edge. And if there were a conflict, a Russian plane got in the way of an American plane, a drone was misinterpreted as an actual manned aircraft on a bombing run, that the default is no longer away from escalation, it probably can go 50-50. And that means that everything has to go right for us to avoid the worst. And the recognition is that we're people, and the president and both countries are human beings, and they make mistakes just like the operators. And that doesn't give me a huge amount of confidence to fall back on.
Yeah, I'm glad you started off with your long-term background with nuclear policy issues, because the way I would articulate this is every 10 years, I think about nuclear weapons. So if it's, and I was in fourth grade when this is happening, so when I say I was thinking, we're really stretching here, but fourth grade, you've got post 9/11, you've got the war in Iraq. Then 2009, 2010, you have President Obama giving his speech, I dream of a world without nuclear weapons. And now we're in the middle of all of this. So can you just give us a articulation of what nuclear policy has looked like since the end of the Cold War? We'll get into the Cold War a bit later, but I think most people have a vague understanding of what the discourse looked like through the 80s. What happened once the population started checking out of that conversation, except for the every 10-year period I just described?
Sure, and I hadn't used the 10-year rule before, but I'm gonna steal that because I think it's a good one. I think the public does have a lot of things to worry about, right? Whether it was terrorism whether it was climate change, whether it was domestic economic issues, right? So it's not a surprise that the public isn't engaged in a daily basis on these issues. I think in part, that's because after the end of the Cold War, our leaders talked about the fact that, you know, the long peace was here, that the nuclear threat had been vanquished. We were working cooperatively with Russia. We actually helped secure Russian nuclear materials and helped Russia get their hands around nuclear weapons that had been deployed at the end of the Soviet Union's existence in Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine, so that we wouldn't have multiple nuclear states born out of the Soviet Union. There would just be one. That would be Russia. That was a lot easier for us to manage and a lot better for the Russians as well. So we went through this period where really nuclear weapons, I won't say were ignored or neglected, but they just weren't seen as being primary elements of American policy. We were worried that one country might get one nuclear weapon, or God forbid that a subnational group like Al-Qaeda or a terrorist group might get one nuclear weapon. That was seen as a strategic threat. When in reality, the United States still maintained 6,000, 5,000, 4,000 nuclear weapons, decided that while we wanted to reduce the number and the role of nuclear weapons, we would maintain a strong arsenal. It was talked about as maintaining it as a hedge against geopolitical realities, that the future might not be as nice as we hope, and therefore we should hold on to this capability because it might go south. And remember, this is at a time when the dominant article in international affairs was by Francis Fukuyama. He wrote a book called The End of History, that this was going to be America's transcendent moment where we would lead the world in a democratic process that would lead to the end of wars and conflict. That clearly was overstated. I don't think anybody in the government actually believed that's where we were headed. But there's no doubt that the nuclear issue basically drifted over a period of time, both under Clinton, then under President George W. Bush. We tended to focus a bit more on nuclear weapons as a tool of war fighting, whereas before they were seen only for strategic roles, you know, a global war with Russia. The people in the Bush administration were a bit more interested in, could we use these things to root out terrorist bunkers? Could we go after terrorist supporting states like Iran or North Korea or Iraq? And maybe nuclear weapons had a role. I think that was pretty quickly rejected. Most people understand that you can't sort of use nuclear weapons, one here and one there, without it getting out of control. But that began, I think, a process which we're now seeing play out, which is we believe, the United States believes, that we're a responsible nuclear state. And so having nuclear weapons makes sense for us. But then we look at other countries like Russia or China or North Korea and say, well, those are irresponsible nuclear states. They shouldn't be able to have them, or we need to maintain them in order to deter their weapons. And the reality is that countries are made up of people. People make mistakes, and people with nuclear weapons sometimes can get caught up in a dynamic that isn't in their strategic interests. And I think now we're seeing play out a scenario that nobody wanted, where a nuclear armed aggressor state like Russia is using their nuclear weapons as a shield behind which they can carry out the invasion of a sovereign state. And that poses a real challenge for the United States policy. But just as we were worried today about Putin, we worried 4 years ago about Trump. And would he use nuclear weapons as a shield? Would he use nuclear weapons? Actually, he threatened to do so in a number of cases. And so the dynamic is one where we're still getting a handle on how, in this world where the United States is not the dominant power, how nuclear weapons work for us or sometimes work against us.
Yeah, really well said. It's so many different things I want to pick up there. Number one, I want to revisit the story you just told about post-Soviet denuclearization. Because up until 2 months ago, I think I would have entirely agreed with that story in the sense that it's not clear to me that it was a good thing that Ukraine lost their nuclear weapons, because they lost their deterrent. That caused the situation. And once again, like, I'm sure there's an obvious answer to this, which is Ukraine in 2022 having nuclear weapons is way different than post Cold War 1990s Ukraine. So I'm definitely aware of that history. Please fill me in. But can you just talk around that dynamic?
Sure, happy to. And there's no need to try and explain it. I think the majority of people in the United States and the world think, oh, Ukraine had nuclear weapons and gave them up. And gee, look at them now, they're suffering. And I think having been active as an adult in the period, it's important to sort of reset where we were. In 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, the 14 other Soviet republics became independent states. And their sovereignty was recognized both by Russia and the United States and the international community. But the nuclear weapons that were left on Ukrainian territory were still operated and protected by Russian strategic rocket forces. Ukraine never got into a missile silo. They never got into a nuclear weapons bunker because there were also tactical nuclear weapons that were left in Ukraine. They were operating at what were then Russian bases left in Ukrainian territory, and the Ukrainians didn't have access to them. Now, the Ukrainians provided services, they cooked meals, they did cleaning, and actually Ukraine had a very advanced missile production facility and was part of the Soviet nuclear rocket complex. And so there were some maintenance workers and design workers, but the Russian nuclear weapons in Ukraine were under Russian control. Ukraine agreed in 1994, after 3 years of negotiations and tensions, that those weapons, in fact, should go back to Russia, and that Ukraine would be compensated for the nuclear material, the uranium that was in those weapons, that they could then use in their nuclear power plants, that they would use them basically to barter away so they could still have electricity produced in their country. But it was clear at the time, and I think the key point here is, it is not, we shouldn't take it as a given that Ukraine could have seized control of those weapons, or that they would have ever become a recognized sovereign state if they tried to secure those weapons. I'm pretty confident at the from my experience at the time that if Ukraine had said, no, those are our weapons, and begun to actually take military steps to seize them, that not only would Russia have responded, but I'm pretty sure the United States would have helped Russia, and we ourselves would have been cooperating with Russia on a military exercise to prevent the Ukrainians from seizing those weapons. Because we were concerned that instead of one nuclear state, Russia, we would have Ukraine born as the third largest nuclear weapons state in the world, with nuclear weapons that could basically reach anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. And that was not a situation that the United States or the West viewed as tenable.
So several key things there. One, when we're talking about 93, 94, we're talking probably like the height of the post-Cold War U.S.-Russia relationship. Boris Yeltsin and Clinton are actual friends at this point. It's very clear that, to your point, if we look at that dynamic, almost certainly we're siding with Russia on that. But then too, and I didn't really realize this until you put it this way, so we should think of those Ukrainian nukes, quote unquote, as more akin to the fact that the Russians had a base in Crimea after the Cold War too, in the sense that it's located in the territory of Ukraine. I didn't know this. Actually, what did Russia want to do with the nukes then? Did Russia want them back? What was the situation?
So Russia wanted two things. One, they didn't want a nuclear armed neighbor next door. And two, those were their nuclear weapons. They were some of the most advanced weapons in the Russian arsenal. And they believed that they needed to maintain a nuclear force. What we ended up doing was helping the Russians with secure transport to ship those weapons back. Most of the warheads basically went into the Russian nuclear complex, and I'm pretty sure that a bunch of the nuclear materials and components have been recycled into current Russian nuclear forces that could potentially be used against the United States and Ukraine. So you could say, oh, this is a really dumb thing for the United States to do. Why would we help Russia sort of reclaim this capability? The reality is, as you said, Boris Yeltsin was seen as a democratic champion in Russia, right? This was really before the long decline in 1998, when the ruble collapsed and we really dealt with major problems in terms of the Russian economy and then the turn towards authoritarianism under Putin, we were cooperating with Russia. We invited them into the G8 group of nations. We helped them join the World Trade Organization. They were building pipelines into Europe because their natural gas and oil were major sources for the economic revolution in Europe, the reintegration of East and West Germany, right? These were all greatly positive trend. So hindsight's always 20/20. There clearly is, looking back, a downside to the fact that Ukraine provided these weapons back to Russia. But I don't think those were really strategic changes looking back. I'm so convinced you probably would not have had a Ukraine had they decided that it was in their interest to get nuclear weapons. And I think interestingly now, even when you look at the current day, it's not clear to me that Russia and Ukraine don't still have a conflict, even if Ukraine is nuclear armed, right? I mean, if Ukraine and Russia both have nuclear weapons and Russia invades, Ukraine is not going to be able to launch a nuclear strike on Moscow because Moscow can destroy Ukraine. The same reason we don't worry day to day about the United States and Russia going to war. We worry about escalation. But again, these things that we're absolutely sure about to me aren't certainties. And we have to recognize that there are always variables and question marks about how history plays out.
Well, and let's spend some time then between neighboring hostile states with nuclear weapons. So obviously India and Pakistan are the one that's going to come to mind. There are border conflicts still. Kashmir isn't resolved. But obviously the actual conventional wars between the country have reduced. So could one not argue that a nuke, like once again, as you've made clear, now we're just dealing in a pure hypothetical, because I, once again, just off the top of my head, I'm pretty convinced that this was a fake alternate reality I'm describing here. But when we're getting to the whole stabilization argument, couldn't you argue, though, that in general, conventional war doesn't escalate between nuclear armed neighbors?
So it not only can you argue it, it has been argued. You know, in international relations theory, there are longstanding debates between academics, none of whom have ever been in a room with a nuclear weapon or, you know, a world leader, who argue that, well, look, nuclear proliferation is a good thing. It's stabilizing. If everybody had nuclear weapons, then nobody would go to war with each other. That obviously hasn't panned out, because you do have conventional wars between nuclear armed states, India and Pakistan being the foremost example. And there's a great old Saturday Night Live skit from back in the 80s where everybody's walking around with a giant silver ball under their arm. And it's like Hydrogen Town, right? And everybody's got a thermonuclear weapon, and some guy drives in out of town and tries to rob the convenience store, and they all laugh at him, right? Because we have nuclear weapons. You're not going to shoot us. It will all be destroyed. And then, of course, he drops the gun, it goes off, it shoots some guy, and then there's just a big mushroom cloud, right? Everything works in nuclear deterrence until it fails. And when it fails horribly. And the example here is that just as the war in Ukraine was starting, you had a military exercise in India where they were moving around and training on cruise missiles, and one of them launched accidentally and landed in Pakistan. It's not clear whether that was a conventional warhead, whether it was an unarmed missile, or whether it was a nuclear warhead. And for a while, Pakistan didn't know either. So, you know, even in the best of situations where countries don't want to have conflict, things go sideways. And I think that is the great lesson about escalation in war. The great example in the nuclear litany is from the Cuban Missile Crisis, where, you know, we stood toe to toe and eyeball to eyeball with the Soviet Union over nuclear weapons in Cuba. And John Kennedy wanted to sort of keep a lid on things so they didn't escalate without our say-so. And he told the military to stop military operations around the Soviet Union. And what happened? We had U-2 spy flights that were going over the Soviet Union. One of them was shot down. Gary Powers was held as a prisoner of war in Russia for a number of years. And Kennedy famously said, why is it there's always someone somewhere who doesn't get the word? You can't control everything. And so in a conflict, you try to reduce the risk that things will get out of control, and recognizing that you're not always going to be able to manage the battle space.
So this gets to my question of what your aims and objectives are. So you're affiliated with Global Zero. So what is your thesis articulation of what our posture towards nuclear weapons, not just in the US, but globally, what should it be?
Sure. And we have, a very basic premise, complicated in its implementation, but at its root is, if there are no nuclear weapons, there cannot be a nuclear war. We don't need to change humanity in order to rid the world of the threat that humanity could be destroyed by nuclear weapons. It's simply a recognition that nuclear weapons are more dangerous and provide more insecurity than any potential benefits. So we don't argue that nuclear deterrence isn't real. We know that countries feel more secure if they have nuclear weapons. We know that countries feel that they can deter strategic attack. But Russia has nuclear weapons in large part because they worry about us using nuclear weapons against it. And we have nuclear weapons in large part because we worry about Russia using nuclear weapons against us. If we can eliminate nuclear weapons as a tool of war fighting, meaning they have no legitimate purpose other than deterrence, then you can very quickly move to very low levels and then eventually under verification eliminate them. The counter argument is, of course, well, aren't you making the world safe for conventional war? And our argument is we're having conventional wars. They are happening now. Nuclear weapons have not brought this great period of peace. Since World War II, we have still lost tens of millions of people to conventional wars around the world. And a number of them almost turned into nuclear wars. And eventually our luck's going to run out. And the consequences of our luck running out are so devastating that it's no longer worth the potential benefits that people espouse. So there's a lot of work to do to convince people that that's true. But we also point out that it wasn't that long ago that American military officials said it absolutely necessity that we have new modern binary chemical weapons. If we don't have these, the United States and our allies will be completely vulnerable. And now we eliminated those. They don't present a threat to the United States or our allies because we changed the way we thought about these weapons. They're not usable weapons of war. They're only weapons of terror, and their elimination is in our interest.
Yeah, and I want to get to, and this is where all the nuclear theorists come into play, but I think it's an interesting question. You are referring to nation states. So the United States, Russia, and the wrinkle when it comes to this perspective is Putin very specifically, right? So, and you actually wrote an op-ed today that we'll get into when it comes to the decision-making around who can authorize the use of nuclear weapons. But if I am Putin right now, nuclear weapons are working in a long-term sustainable way because they mean, and Biden, I think, is very accurately accorded this, I agree with all these decisions, we will not risk anything that could result in attack in the use of a tactical nuclear weapon. Therefore, we will not intervene. We're not going to send the MiGs, no fly zones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in this scenario, when this isn't really about nation state versus nation state analysis, but this actually is deeply personal under the auspices of specific individuals, how does that maybe jiggle with, I think, inconveniently with this model?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, for right now, Putin is using nuclear weapons to his advantage. Kim Jong-un in North Korea uses nuclear weapons to his advantage. So we don't argue that, okay, well, we're going to negotiate these treaties and they'll be implemented and then the bad guys will be good guys, right? Mm-hmm. What we argue is that why should the United States, who, quite frankly, we don't need a lot of nuclear weapons. You know, Ukraine doesn't even need nuclear weapons. They can stymie Russia pretty effectively with a bunch of anti-tank missiles and anti-aircraft missiles, right? I mean, but the United States is the world's conventional superpower, much more so than we even realized a month ago, right? We were worried that Russia was somehow a peer competitor that can't beat a country that has 1/10 its defense budget. So we can reduce our nuclear weapons to a much smaller level. Why should we do anything that makes it legitimate for a country to threaten the use of nuclear weapons first, right? That threat that Russia or North Korea reserves the right to use nuclear weapons in itself should be abhorrent. But we can't take that stand because we continue to threaten the potential first use of nuclear weapons ourselves. Right now, we are imposing sanctions on Russia and potentially secondary sanctions on countries that help Russia because he's invaded a country and done something we consider to be unacceptable. Well, we should consider the first use of nuclear weapons to be unacceptable. We should negotiate deep cuts to both our weapons and Russian and Chinese and other weapons in order to make the first use of nuclear weapons much less likely. And if it takes the United States and Russia negotiating much broader agreement, so we include things like conventional force deployments, missile defenses, which Russia is very concerned about, advanced hyperglide missiles, which we're concerned about Russia having. If you have a broader arrangement. So hyperglide missiles are missiles that are able to maneuver and therefore evade missile defenses. Hmm. And so we see the Russians and the Chinese worried that the United States will develop nationwide missile defenses, develop these new maneuverable systems so they can ensure that their nuclear weapons can hit us if they get into a war with us. And so we see this broader arms race dynamic, which we tried desperately to avoid in the 1970s through arms control. It worked for a few decades and then began to fall apart because the United States changed the way we thought about those dynamics. But the reality is that Russia and China are increasing their capabilities. They are going to use nuclear weapons in ways that undermine our security. That doesn't mean that we should simply change our tone in terms of how we develop nuclear weapons or how we focus on deterrence, but we should be doing everything we can to make the world not safe for nuclear weapons, as opposed to creating space for countries to use them.
I think the key takeaway I'm hearing from what you're saying is obviously global zero is the objective, but there's actually a wide amount of space between those two things where there's a lot of like wiggle room in either direction. So I'm sure there are parts here. So let's actually get into and set the table a bit here. How many nuclear weapons do we actually have? And then how are those nuclear weapons effectively deployed? Like, this is going to bring up the nuclear triad. As I understand, it's actually four, but like, let's just talk about this part here.
Sure. So, yeah, getting back to basics. So the United States has about 3,800 nuclear weapons in its arsenal, and we deploy them on five different means of delivery. We have our strategic triad, meaning our long-range capabilities that really can go anywhere in the world. We have 400 long-range ground-based missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. We have 14 ballistic missile-armed submarines that can carry a couple of thousand nuclear weapons. And then we have a small fleet of B-52 and B-2 strategic bombers that can carry both cruise missiles and airdrop gravity bombs. And then we also deploy in Europe short-range gravity bombs that can be deployed on fighter bomber aircraft like the F-16 and eventually the F-35. So we have these five different means of delivery: ICBM, SLBMs, bombers with cruise missiles, bombers with bombs, and then fighter bomber aircraft with bombs. Russia has about 4,500, maybe 5,000 strategic weapons. They might have a few thousand tactical short-range nuclear weapons that could also be used in and around Europe or in East Asia. And then you see France, UK, and China with a much smaller arsenals, 200, 300, 400 each. Britain has said that they might go up as high as 1,000. China now looks like they could potentially build up in the next decade or two to about 1,000. And then we have countries like India, Israel, and Pakistan with maybe a couple of hundred each. So the big players are still the United States and Russia, with the other seven nuclear powers or states far below that.
And something I'd like to get at is, let's understand the process by which we've actually reduced missile count. So there was this important process called New START. This was a treaty, 2010, 2011, 2012, obviously. What's interesting here is, and this is actually where the political part gets a little mixed. So very clearly, there's this public discourse around, wow, Mitt Romney was right when he smacked Obama at the debate over thinking that Russia was the number one geopolitical threat to the United States. And I think Obama's rhetoric on that stage was mistaken. I think it hasn't aged well. But something that people don't think about is implicit in that critique was opposition to New START and that nuclear reduction policy. So can you basically unpack the 2010 to 2012 period by which this is happening, which resulted in Russia and the US reducing their missile counts, as I understand it?
Sure. The debate with Romney, I think, is an important point, but I think there's a longer continuum here that's worth reminding people. And, you know, I'm now in my mid-50s, and so I came of age at the end of the Cold War and worked with a number of the people who actually invented arms control, who invented nuclear deterrence. Some of the people actually invented nuclear weapons. We used to focus on arms control as a tool to manage the nuclear competition with our primary enemy, the Soviet Union. There was no debate about the Soviet Union being an enemy. They threatened global domination. They threatened our existence in Europe and that of our allies. They occupied sovereign states, many of whom are now NATO members. But we recognized that arms control was not something you did with friends or colleagues. It's something you did to put guardrails in place so you didn't have a full-blown nuclear arms race. We learned all too late that arms races don't bring security. There is no such thing as nuclear superiority. It took us building 35,000 nuclear weapons. At one point, the United States had 10 times the nuclear weapons we had today. And we learned that there's no way to build up to a point where you can dominate. And so slowly in the 1960s and 70s, we began a process of negotiating with the Soviet Union reductions. We did that through agreements called the SALT agreements, the Strategic Arm Limitation Talks. Then Ronald Reagan began the START talks, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, which was actually negotiated by the founder of Global Zero, Rick Burt. And then in 2010, the last or the most recent step in that process was the new START treaty. And through that process, we went from having about 35,000 nuclear weapons here, about 40 nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union, to where we had 1,550 strategic nuclear weapons accountable in each country. We knew that each side had a bit more because they count the weapons in sort of arcane ways, but we knew we were limiting the areas of competition and the types and different forms that nuclear weapons could take. So for example, it limited the ability of Russia and the United States to deploy strategic nuclear weapons outside its territory, right? So the Soviet Union and Russia weren't deploying strategic nuclear weapons in Cuba, and we weren't deploying strategic nuclear weapons in, say, Japan. That was something that both sides recognized were a problem. We also negotiated something called the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, so that neither side had missiles between ranges of about 300 and 3,000 miles in range that could be deployed in Europe or in Cuba. That was seen as being stabilizing because if you had missiles that close, they could reach capitals in 5 minutes, 8 minutes. That's not a lot of time for a president to make decisions about firing back. That treaty, unfortunately, is no longer in existence. Donald Trump withdrew from it, and Soviet Union, Russia is now deploying missiles in that range. And so we're seeing the elements ratchet up. But I think you're right that the challenge we have is that arms control has played a role over the last decades, but just like most things in Washington, anything and everything has become controversial. And so whereas arms control treaties used to pass by wide margins in the Senate, 90, 95, 4, 3 or 5 against, the New START treaty was villainized by the GOP and only got 77 votes. Smallest margin for an arms control treaty. This is the same Senate that rejected a UN treaty on the rights of the disabled, right? So treaties are a hard thing for the Senate to do these days because just talking to each other is a hard thing for the Senate to do. So it limits the ability to use arms control as a tool, but there's no doubt that we are better off because we're able to do inspections in Russia right now, and Russia is able to do inspections in the United States right now. Even today, when we are sanctioning Russia and Russians are sanctioning us, this treaty is still in force. And that gives us some confidence that neither side is breaking out to try to gain strategic domination.
Something I want to get to is how we even conceptualize and conceive of nuclear weapons, because a very clear thing that's come out, and I don't know to the degree to which this is true, but military analysts have spoken of this way, which is that the Russians at a tactical doctrine, strategic level, actually just think, especially when it comes to a tactical nuclear weapon, that's just kind of a big bomb. It's actually a piece of artillery. This is not a weapon which initiates Armageddon the same way an ICBM would. So can you actually just speak to the real clear gap in conceptualization that's coming about here and how that does and doesn't hamper the, because a quick editorial point here, you know, look, if you think about it, like the firebombing of Tokyo killed far more people than either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So what are we actually dealing with there, especially when it's localized? So yeah, just please love your response.
Yeah, it's there's an old quote that both sides always have the same negotiating position, just at different times. Mm. And so when nuclear weapons were invented by the United States, Curtis LeMay, who was the head of Strategic Air Command, viewed them as just a great way to start fires. He said, with one airplane, I can do what it took me days and hundreds of aircraft to do in Tokyo or Dresden. In fact, nuclear weapons were much different. We learned that very quickly as their explosive power became larger, particularly with the invention of thermonuclear or hydrogen bombs. We recognized that these were city killers, that one could destroy a capital or a major city of millions. And so we, the United States, developed these as strategic weapons. Then over time, it was actually Eisenhower who said, you know, these are really just big bullets. We can use these to compensate for our perceived conventional inferiority to the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And then over time, we recognized, and it took us decades to get to this point, to realize that there is no way to use nuclear weapons in a tactical role.
And a quick thing, because I want to get people to understand this explicitly. What that's referring to is in the 1950s, obviously the Soviets and the Warsaw Pact had we're not talking technological, conventional advantage. We're saying literally there were millions and millions and millions of more Soviet soldiers and Warsaw Pact allies in Europe than there were American soldiers. So the thought was, okay, tactical, like these nuclear weapons could actually serve to push back against that advantage they would have. Because the perception was without nuclear weapons, they could reach Spain in a couple weeks.
We argued for decades that the only thing holding back a Soviet invasion of Europe was the fact that we threatened to use nuclear weapons to destroy their tank formations and their troop concentrations. It turns out the Soviet Union had no plans to invade Europe. They were worried that we were going to invade Eastern Europe and Russia the same way that Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, the same way that Napoleon invaded Russia. You know, these are long historical roots. But over time, we recognized that nuclear weapons really were unusable, that they would bring escalation because the Soviet Union could launch nuclear weapons at us in the United States in response. Now the roles have reversed. And Russia argues that because they are conventionally inferior, because the West and NATO have conventional superiority in terms of technology, that they threaten to use nuclear weapons if the existence of the Russian state is put at risk. And we believe, and I think the invasion of Ukraine has played this out, that Putin views his existence as the same as the existence of the Russian state. And so we worry. This
is the whole problem of authoritarianism thing.
Exactly, right. You know, l'état c'est moi, right? He is the state. And so if he's at risk, then nuclear weapons are on the table. Whether he believes that, whether the military in Russia believes that or would execute that, I think is an open question. But they're trying to create ambiguity and uncertainty in order to increase their room of maneuverability. And so we used to have this position. We no longer view it as acceptable. Russia now has this position and it poses a challenge for us. And the way we respond to that challenge is what we have said now for three administrations, which is that any use of nuclear weapons by Russia would alter the nature of any conflict that they are engaged in and would change the objectives of the United States and its allies in responding to the war. That's a long-winded diplomatic way of saying, if you use a nuke, all bets are off. You can't get away with using a small nuclear weapon and think that, well, it was small, so it doesn't matter.
It's not a bomb.
A nuke is a nuke. And so if you use one, then all of our options are available. That could include nuclear response if necessary. It could include massive increases in conventional capabilities. It could lead us to say, we will no longer accept in power a leader that uses nuclear weapons first. And so we've tried to deter the use of nuclear weapons by saying you can't get away with it. But in a crisis, in a conflict, when Putin is backed into a corner, we don't know that that's an absolute guarantee, which gets back to Global Zero's point, which is there are no absolute guarantees unless you get rid of all nuclear weapons.
So in this last section, I want to get to the points of frustration, which is, given everything you've said, I'm happy you said at the start of the episode that the principal difference between this era and the Cold War era is just the multipolar nature of this situation, like actual countries. And this is example how this can be a bad thing relative to the fact that we think that autonomy is a good thing. Other countries have a vote and a say in a way they did not in the past. So given the fact that Muammar Gaddafi famously gave up his, once again, it wasn't clear he was actually going to develop nukes, but like he very explicitly post Iraq gave up his nascent nuclear program. And then within 7 years is overthrown, obviously. And now given the fact that there's this story of look at little Ukraine, they had nukes. Obviously, the dynamics that you are describing are there, but like that's a technicality. If I'm the leader of a smaller country versus a more powerful conventional rival, mm-hmm. Right. They gave up everything, and now look at them. What argument could possibly convince small to medium powers with the scientific know-how to not pursue nuclear weapons?
Yeah, it not only is it a great question, but it's one that is really, I think, commonsensical, right? And there are other examples too. Saddam Hussein, we were worried he was developing nuclear weapons, and so we invaded. He didn't have nuclear weapons, he wasn't building them. And in fact, an Indian general famously said, the lesson of Iraq is, don't take on the United States unless you have nuclear weapons first, right? You can hold the United States.
Which is what Russia, China, North Korea, Iran's a little complicated, but like this, this actually explains the global stage right now.
How do we explain that we will spend next year potentially $850 billion on defense, right, in the United States, but that we are neutralized by tiny countries like North Korea or Iran that have nuclear weapons, right? It seems to be a mismatch in capabilities. And the reality is that once a country has nuclear weapons, it severely limits your options and your freedom of movement because they have the ability to deter you. Two is better than one, but I think, you know, one is enough, right? If Iran were to say to us, yeah, we built a nuclear weapon and we put it in an American city, and if you put one toe across our border, we're going to detonate it, that would be a pretty effective deterrent against the United States. Now, if our strategic interests are at stake, if we saw Iran invading other countries and we decided it was, you know, worth the risk, you know, we might chance it, but I don't want to be in a world where I have to chance it. But the reality is that countries are now weighing whether or not nuclear weapons are going to be in their security interests. One of the ways the United States has been able to hold back that urge, because it's not new, is through alliances, where we say, if you are part of a military alliance with the United States like NATO, you don't need nuclear weapons because you are part of a nuclear alliance. So when we say to Poland and the Baltic states and Romania and Germany and Italy and the Czech Republic, you're part of a nuclear club. You don't need to build them yourselves. You build conventional weapons. You build economic power at home. That has resonated up until the point that we have leaders like Donald Trump or others in the United States who are more isolationist and say, well, why are we paying to protect Europe? Why are we paying to protect Japan and South Korea? These are major countries. They have the ability to protect themselves. Then they start to go, well, wait a second, maybe the United States isn't going to be there for us. And the reality is that one of the reasons we built these alliances, one of the reasons that we maintain a global system of allies, is because it is worse for the United States if there are 20 nuclear countries in the world instead of nine, mm-hmm. or 30 nuclear countries instead of nine. The more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more likely that there will be a nuclear war.
So it's worse for everybody, not just the United States in this case.
But it's altruistic, but it's also self-interest. Mm-hmm. The more countries that have nuclear weapons, the less special our nuclear forces are, the less we are able to use our conventional military capabilities and our advantages. And the more likely a nuclear war is, the more likely we get sucked in. Because if there's a nuclear war, think about nuclear wars like COVID that happens overnight. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the impact on the global economy, the impact on migration flows, the impact on supply chains, the impact on just our ability to survive and thrive is threatened if nuclear war happens anywhere. Forget the fact that you're talking about potentially, nuclear winter, radiation spreading around the globe, increase in cancer deaths, mass extinctions in animal kingdom and areas being uninhabitable. People forget that nuclear weapons are not just really big bombs. They can devastate huge areas of the planet. When I was growing up, we had nuclear tests going off under the desert. You would see these huge areas of the desert rumble. Now they're all great, black and white or some colorized atmospheric tests, but they destroyed islands. You can go to Google Earth and look over the Marianas Islands or the atolls in the Pacific and see these islands before and after. They're just wiped away. So imagine, the island of Manhattan destroyed or downtown Los Angeles or all of Chicago in the blink of an eye. So, these are devastating weapons, but the fact that countries are going to be looking at their nuclear options and we need to be coming up with better ways of preventing countries from wanting nuclear weapons and also from getting them. So one of the other things we've done over the decades is when a country makes a decision to try to go nuclear, we try to stop them. We sometimes resort to blockades. Sometimes we resort to restricting their access to technology. Sometimes we give them incentives to stay non-nuclear. They don't always work, but they have slowed down programs. And the hope is that over time, we'll still be able to hold the line. But I think there's a lot of reason for pessimism these days as you look at the dynamics in Libya, Iraq, North Korea. Nuclear weapons tend to be effective if you look at the minutia. When you look at the geostrategic picture, they're not really in the interest of the United States to spread.
So two big questions here. One, it seems as if the issue standing in the way of the world you're describing as ideal is the fact that nations broadly, in very specific geopolitical circumstances, do not feel like they have security. So Russia, and I think it's insane. People say I've been way too anti-Russia lately, but it's insane that Putin would argue that there was a legitimate threat that a somehow European Union that's spending less than 2% of GDP intended on using Ukraine as a highway to take Moscow. We do not live in the era of Hitler or Napoleon. So there's, once again, though, there's a gap. So nations do not feel like their security interests are actually contained. I think the interesting counterpoint is, well, the French and Germans now are no longer fighting over Alsace-Lorraine, so they feel as if the security is... So how at a broader level do you think we convince great powers? Let's start there. Like, the small countries are going to have issues no matter what. But how do we convince great powers that no one is trying to conquer them anymore? Because I think post-Iraq, post-Libya, I think it's just impossible to argue this in all seriousness.
So I did not have Alsace-Lorraine on my bingo card this morning. So, well played. I think there's no perfect answer here. And I don't really know what is at Putin's base motives. I think he does worry about being deposed. I think he worries about the creep of freedom and democracy and information and, the Russian people wanting to have a different way of being governed. I think he worries a lot more about a sphere of influence around him He wants these buffer states, and increasingly we worry that he wants this reclaimed Russian empire, that that's part of what Ukraine is about, part of what Poland's about, and potentially the Baltic states. So I don't know for sure, but he has talked a lot about insecurity and talked a lot about color revolutions in Eastern Europe being a challenge for him. It's why he's reaching out and trying to undermine democracy everywhere from Hungary and Poland to the United States. He views that as a way of responding to what he sees as American intervention in his backyard. The fact that we're not actually intervening, we're just sort of standing here going, yeah, we like democracy and we think it's a good thing, but he views it differently. One answer that we have pursued for many, many years is integration. That if a country is integrated into a global economy and has a stake in the status quo, they are less likely to want to undertake military operations themselves, and they are less worried that we ourselves will intervene in their country. That hasn't worked so well in Russia because we've had a despotic leader, and we've sort of looked the other way at invasions in Georgia and Moldova and the brutality in Chechnya and Syria. But it has worked well in other countries. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the open question is China. China is as integrated into the global economy as anybody. They haven't undertaken military invasions of other countries. We worry about their potential to reclaim Taiwan. We worry about their desire or their intention to take Taiwan by force. I think now they're probably revisiting their assumptions about how strong the military is, how capable a Taiwan on its own or with the support of the United States might be. And I think they're also recognizing that as the Russian economy craters, that they are just as vulnerable, if not more, to economic measures as Russia has been. So I think there's a whole reassessment we need to do in terms of China, but economic integration has been one of the tools. The other tool we have tried, and I think this is one of the criticisms about the invasion of Iraq, is that the United States is guilty of ignoring the international sovereignty of countries when it suits our interest. It doesn't excuse what Russia is doing, but it's very hard to seize the moral high ground and say, well, you shouldn't be invading Ukraine when we ourselves invaded Iraq in 2001 under false purpose, 2002 under false pretenses. It's interesting that Russia has used the very same language that George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Doug Feith and Paul Wolfowitz used when and John Bolton when justifying the invasion of Iraq. They were terrorists. They were developing chemical and biological weapons or nuclear mm-hmm. weapons. And we had to protect ourselves against a country that was coming for us. That's almost identical to what Russia has said in Ukraine. Now, you can argue that George Bush meant it and believed it. I know that Donald Rumsfeld and other people below him didn't believe it and knew that it was made up. And I don't know whether Putin believes it or makes it up, but he's clearly using that language to his advantage. And so the problem is not just whether or not we're successful in integrating countries into the global economy, but whether or not we're going to abide by the rules ourselves and can use that as a way to build norms and enforce them in the future.
A good way to finish up would be this question of, does nuclear arms reduction, let alone abolishment, require that leaders and countries not have 20th or 19th century mindsets? Because it seems to me, as you're getting to the core of like why Putin specifically is causing all this trouble, is he's bringing this 19th century territory, empire, this city was owned by this country in 1100s, like whatever. That mentality just seems incompatible specifically with what we're really talking about here today. And obviously it's easy to dunk on Francis Fukuyama, but I think what Fukuyama was getting at, and I think this is an important idea, which is certain visions of international affairs require certain mindsets or state of affairs. When history is happening, quote unquote, it's much easier to justify the existence of nuclear arsenals. So how do you just respond to this idea to finish up?
Sure. Look, I think at the core of your question is one of the arguments that's been made by people, totally responsible, legitimate, acceptable, you know, people in the public discourse about why we need to maintain nuclear weapons and deterrence, right? That unless and until human nature changes, unless and until we have eradicated poverty and the root causes of war and inequality, then we can't get rid of nuclear weapons. And I view it differently, which is that the process of negotiating and reducing nuclear weapons opens up areas of cooperation and engagement and new ways of working together as states for collective security. And a recognition that any use of nuclear weapons anywhere could bring about the end of all existence everywhere is something that all leaders need to understand. And if they cannot understand and accept that, then the world should not accept them as leaders. Now, we're not there today, but over time, the United States and other countries have said that certain behavior is unacceptable, right? Mm-hmm. If there were full nation states that were engaged in the slave trade, that would be unacceptable. When we see countries that are engaged in global terrorism, we view that as unacceptable. When there are countries that are engaged in deforestation or environmental degradation, we're not at the point where we dispose those leaders, but we do work cooperatively and bring pressure to bear so that they no longer engage in those activities because it affects us, right? So by negotiating, we can open up those new areas of exploration to determine, can we get to zero? When Global Zero says we can get there, we're not saying, oh yeah, it's easy. What we're saying is that technically we have the means to verify the elimination of nuclear weapons and ensure that material never ends up back in a nuclear weapon. The question is whether or not we have the political will to do so. But when we're sitting on 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 nuclear weapons each, we're so far away from the dividing line of safe and unsafe that we need to continue working that problem aggressively now. Because as we've seen, the longer we postpone that question, the greater are the number of days that we live with existential risk. And we roll the dice every day. The U.S. Strategic Command is very fond of saying, we use our nuclear weapons every day. We use them to deter, we use them to protect, we use them to reassure. And we agree with that. We think we do use our nuclear weapons every day. Every day we roll a bunch of dice, like Yahtzee. And one day it's going to roll five sixes, and that's a real problem for us. And so it wouldn't be better if at the same time we were building a stable deterrent relationship, at the same time we were reassuring our allies, we were moving as aggressively as possible to reduce the role of nuclear weapons. That's not where we are. That's where we think we should be. And that's one of the things we think that will actually make it easier, not harder, to engage with adversaries and allies in a different construct.
That is an excellent place to end. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been incredibly helpful.
Marshall, it's really been great. I enjoyed it, and I hope it's useful to your listeners.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.